Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. In this audio, I intend to cover Genesis chapter 14, verses 1 through 16, which I will entitle Abram Rescues Lot, his nephew Lot. Our context is this. In the last chapter, I covered the whole 18 verses. Abram separated from Lot. They stood there at Bethel and looked out over the land. Their flocks were competing with one another, and Abram said, "You can take what land you want, Lot." And Lot said, looked over the east of the Dead Sea and down there to the south and says, "I'll take that." And he goes down to Sodom, his new home. Abram kept the less rich and valuable lands in the center of Canaan. So we start now with Genesis 14:1. Now I'm going to warn you as I go through this, there's a lot of difficult ancient names and geography to go through. I'm going to try to skim through it, without being too superficial. Try to give you the overview of militarily what was happening here. So we start with verse 1 in Genesis 14. "And it came about in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim." Now, these are four kings from Mesopotamia. Shinar is the southern part of the Mesopotamian Valley, basically coterminous with Babylon. Elam is just to the east of Mesopotamia, right across the Tigris River in southeastern present-day Iran. And so, just to keep things a little simple here, I'm going to call these the four kings of Mesopotamia. Actually, I'm sometimes going to call them the four kings of Elam, because Elam is the top dog in this coalition. That is the ancient Near Eastern kingdom that lasted for centuries. So this is Chedorlaomer's coalition. Now, Amraphel, king of Shinar, he used to be thought to be Hammurabi, the guy that did the famous Hammurabi Code, whose stele is in the Louvre in Paris, but not anymore, so he's unknown. King of Shinar, I don't know if that's the area. It's probably a town there in the area of Shinar in southern Babylon. Arioch, king of Elasar. Arioch means lion-like, venerable. And Chedorlaomer, as I said earlier, is the king of Elam, the capital of which is Susa. That's where Daniel died, so that's a very famous place. And then we've got one more of these kings. His name is Tidal, king of Goim. Now, Goim might be a place that's unclear. It could just be a common noun referring to a non-Hebrew person. You've heard the old saying, the Jewish mother doesn't want her son to marry a Goim. It means a Gentile. These kings are not well known or not famous for any other reason, so we're just going to call this the four kings of Mesopotamia, the Mesopotamian kings on one side of this battle that's coming up. If you look at a map, as the Euphrates River comes down to meet the Tigris River right above the Persian Gulf, at that little body of water called Shat el-Arab, we see that Elasar, one of the confederation of the four Mesopotamian kings, is actually listed on the map with a question mark. They're not exactly sure where it is. It looks like it's very close to Ur, a little bit upstream of the Euphrates from Ur. But anyway, these cities are well known as part of ancient, well, I say well known. There's our liberals, of course, who doubt the existence. They would doubt the existence of New York City if they were living 100 years from now. But they have not definitely been established. But I have no reason to doubt the scripture that talks about this confederation of kings that's going to fight this battle. We go down to verse 2. "They made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and king of Bela," that is Zoar. Now, the names of these kings are not known anywhere else. We're not going to worry about them too much. But in order to make things simple, I'm going to call these five kings the five cities of the plain, is the way most scholars call them. But I'm going to call them the five Dead Sea Kings, because they were located starting at the southeastern coast of the Dead Sea, or the Salt Sea, as it was called back then. And if you go south, you go Sodom, Gomorrah, Zoar, Admah, and Zeboim. As you go south and get past the Dead Sea and go further down the Arabah Valley there. And so these five kings were close to the Salt Sea, the Dead Sea, so I'm going to call them the Dead Sea Kings. Now, Zoar had another name, Bela. This is where Lot fled after he had to get out of Sodom before it got burnt up. He went to Zoar, right there, which is south of Sodom and Gomorrah, north of Admah and Zeboim, right south of the Dead Sea, of the Salt Sea. It was also called Bela, which means a thing swallowed, a nice name for a city. Birsha was the king of Gomar. Birsha, that name means son of wickedness, another great name for a king. The king of Sodom was called Bera, which means gift or son of evil. My granddaughter is named Bera, one of my granddaughters, and when I happened to read this after I knew her name, I said, oh my gosh, she's named like the king of Sodom is. But it can mean gift too, so I guess that's the good news. But son of evil is a good name for Sodom. And then we got Shemeba, which means soaring on high, and he was the king of Zebulun. We go now to Genesis 14, 3 through 4. All these came as allies to the valley of Siddim. These that are talking about are the five cities of the plain, the five Dead Sea kings. They came as allies to the valley of Siddim. That's the Salt Sea. Now, whether it's the actual Salt Sea or whether it's the valley around the Salt Sea, scholars differ, but basically it's the Salt Sea area. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, that's the king of Elam, but the 13th year they rebelled. Now, it's not clear whether it's after 13 years of rebelling then the war started, or after 12 years of when they first took the yoke of King Chedorlaomer of Elam that they rebelled. I think it's the latter, because I can't believe that Elam would have let five kings rebel for 13 years or 12 years plus before Elam decided to come over there and stop the rebellion. It's a minor point. Now, this Valley of Siddim, let me read you a little bit from Easton's dictionary, remembering now that Easton's was written in the late 19th century. Valley of Siddim, quote, valley of the broad plains, which is the Salt Sea between En-Gedi and the cities of the plain. Cities of the plain are the five cities I just talked about, Sodom, Gomorrah, Zoar, Admah, and Zeboim. And En-Gedi is the city that's halfway down the western coast of the Dead Sea, where a bunch of palm trees are. I've actually been by there, didn't actually see it, but I went by the road that led to it. So, Valley of the Broad Plains at the south end of the Dead Sea. It was full of slime pits. The Revised Version has bitumen pits, asphalt, basically, tar. Here, Chedorlaomer and the Confederate kings overthrew the kings of Sodom and the cities of the plain. So there's a spoiler. The cities of the plain are going down. God, afterwards, on account of their wickedness, overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities, and the smoke of their destruction went up as the smoke of a furnace. All of that destruction was visible from Mamre, where Abraham dwelt, the oaks of Mamre near Hebron. Some contend that the cities of the plain were somewhere in the north of the Dead Sea, but that's nobody thinks that anymore, as far as I can tell. The NASB, the NIV, as well as Easton's, makes it appear that the Salt Sea is the Valley of Siddim. Because of this phrase here in the NASB, the Valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. Now, if that's the case, that means the armies fought in the slime pits. And later on, water covered up the slime pits, and it later became the Salt Sea. Or if not, it would mean that the Salt Sea was already there, and they fought in the valley around the Salt Sea that was already there. It's a minor point. Just bring it up. Now, another minor point is the Salt Sea was not called the Salt Sea at that time. Here's what John Gill says. It was afterwards so called. Not at this time, for then it would not have been fit for armies to be drawn up in battle array in it. Well, Gill says that, but he could refer to the fact that they were fighting in the valley around it. But it was so called the Salt Sea in the time of Moses, Gill continues, and after this fine veil was turned into a bituminous lake, an asphalt lake, and had its name from the saltness of the waters of the lake, or from the city Melek, or city of salt, which was near it. So John Gill says the name Salt Sea is anachronistic. Again, a minor point. Now the Salt Sea, the Dead Sea, the NIV Study Bible says, it contained 25% concentration of chloride and bromide salts, like sodium chloride salt. It's the densest large body of water on Earth, 25%. It's 1,300 feet below sea level, which is, I think, is the lowest. No, I'm not sure it's the lowest. It's one of the lowest seas on the planet. Now, I floated in the Dead Sea, and we were told by tour guides, don't you get turned over in that water, because that water will hold you up. You won't be able to get your feet back on the ground, and your head could get held under the water as you struggle to push against that salt, and you might not be able to get your head above water, and you might drown. I didn't like that. So I was very careful, but yes, you go out there, and you just float just as happy as you please. Maybe waist high. I can't remember how high the upper part of my body was up, but you just couldn't sink in that water. Very interesting place. Now let's get off of some geography here. And let's talk about the fact, something a little bit more theological, the fact that these five cities of the plain, five cities of the Salt Sea, were serving Chedorlaomer. Now, if you recall, Noah, after he was found drunk and covered up by Shem and Japheth and found drunk by Ham, Noah said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." So Noah said that Canaan was going to be the servant of Shem. Canaan, remember, was the son of Ham, and so Ham slash Canaan are the cursed ones, and the blessed ones are Shem. And here we see, according to John Gill at least, here we see that an instance of that, the four kings of in the Elamite confederacy, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, the Mesopotamian kings, they were Semites, and they conquered the Canaanites, the Hamites slash Canaanites, who were living south of the Dead Sea. So here's what Gil says, king of Elam, who was of the race of Shem, and so the prophecy of Noah began to be fulfilled that Canaan should be servant to Shem. This battle helped fulfill a prophecy that Noah had made that Canaan should serve Shem. The five kings of the Salt Sea, the five Canaanite kings, would serve the four Semite kings in the confederation of Elam in Mesopotamia. For the kings of Sodom and Zedar and their subjects were of the race of Ham in the line of Canaan, who had by violence seized on that part of the earth which was allotted to the sons of Shem. And therefore, Chedorlaomer, being a descendant of his, a descendant of Shem, claimed his right and made the Canaanites, the five cities of the plain, the five cities of the Salt Sea, made them tributary to him, tributary to Chedorlaomer, which they were for the space of 12 years. Now, I don't know how Gil knows who got distributed what land. I don't know how he knows that, but it's interesting that the Semites are already beating the Canaanites, as according to that curse of Noah. We go now to Genesis 14:5. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim and the Zuzim in Ham and the Emin in Shavah-Kiriathaim. Now, I'm sure you're not familiar with those places. So let's see how Chedorlaomer and the four Mesopotamian kings came into the land of Canaan in order to conquer and plunder. First of all, they defeated the Rephaim. Now, the Rephaim were the aborigines of Palestine. They came from who knows where, but they were just there when the Israelites came in. And now when the Elamites are coming in, here's what Easton's Illustrated Dictionary says about the Rephaim. They were lofty men, giants. The aborigines of Palestine, afterwards conquered and dispossessed by the Canaanite tribes, are classed under this general title. They were known to the Moabites as Emim, right here in this verse, and Emim means fearful, and to the Ammonites as Zamzumin, which might be the Zumin that's referred to in this verse. Some of them found refuge among the Philistines, and they were still existing in the days of David. Remember, he fought against a giant. That was probably a Rephaim. We know nothing of the origin of the Rephaim. They were not necessarily connected with the giants of the Nephilim of Genesis 6:4, where a lot of people like to say that, but not necessarily true, that is. So that's the Rephaim. It's a good idea to remember that word because it does pop up in Old Testament history. Aboriginal giants. Now, the first place that the Mesopotamian kings under Chedorlaomer conquered was Ashtaroth, or as it's called here, Ashtaroth-Karnaim, which translated is Ashtaroth of the Two Horns. This is where Rephaim lived. Two-horned means is Karnaim. It comes from the crescent moon. This is about 28 miles south of Damascus as you look at the map. Ashtaroth is on the atlas.org map. Ashtaroth is right to the east of the Golan Heights in northern Israel. Next, the Mesopotamian kings went to get the Zuzim. If you go down south and just a little bit west, still in present-day Jordan, east of the Jordan River, you see on the atlas.org map, Ham, with a question mark, so they're not exactly sure where that is, but we're assuming that's further down south, east of the Jordan River, the Zuzim. According to Easton's, the name means restless, sprouting. They were smitten in Ham by Chedorlaomer and his allies. Well, that's what we just read. Some have identified this tribe with the Zamzumins. Well, who were the Zamzumins? According to Easton's, they were a race of giants, a people great and many and tall as the Anakims. Again, these Zamzumins, the Enims, and the Anakims, they're just offspring of the aboriginal Rephaim. And the Zamzumins were overcome by the Ammonites, who are, of course, in present-day Jordan, right east of the Jordan River, about halfway south down, halfway down the Dead Sea. They were overcome by the Ammonites, who call them Zamzumins. They belong to the Rephaim. The Zamzumins, who might be the Zuzim, they belonged to the Rephaim and inhabited the country afterwards occupied by the Ammonites. It has been conjectured that they might be Hamzumans, i.e. Zumans dwelling in Ham, a place apparently to the south of Ashtaroth. Well, and that the ancient Rabbath Ammon, which of course is a famous city, and that's where we get the name Ammon, Jordan, Rabbath Ammon. So basically we're talking about the four kings of Elam, starting in Syria, in present-day Syria, Padamaram as it was called, south of Damascus, heading down east of the Jordan River, down into Ammon, and taking on the Zamzumans, or the Zuzums, in a place of Ham. I've talked all about Ham in the Table of Nations audio in Genesis 10. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that again. I will say this interesting fact about Ham. The race of Ham were the most energetic of all the descendants of Noah in the early times of the post-diluvian world. They're said to go out all through the Pacific Islands and into the Americas and all over the place. Africa, Egypt. But here, by the way, it's not referring to Egypt according to John Gill. No, it's referring to present-day Jordan. Then the four kings of Mesopotamia under the leadership of Elam went further south, and they ended up fighting the Emin. Now, the Emin are in ancient Moab, which is east of the Dead Sea, about halfway down from the north to the south. So halfway down from the Dead Sea, further on south, till you get down into Mount Seir, into Edom. That would be Moab, very well defined on the map when we get to the Exodus. And so the Emin lived in Moab, and I assume that it is the same branch of the Rephaim with a different name, but by different people. Here's what Easton's dictionary says about the Emin, quote, terrors, great name, a warlike tribe of giants who were defeated by Chedorlaomer. In the time of Abraham, they occupied the country east of Jordan, afterwards the land of the Moabites. I've already said that. They were, like the Anakim, reckoned among the Rephaim, and were conquered by the Moabites, who gave them the name of Emims, terrible men. So again, it's just another name for the same bunch of people that sprung from these aboriginal giants called Rephaim. And Easton says the Ammonites call them Zamzumans. So the same people from Rephaim in Ammon were called Zamzumans. The same people from Rephaim further south in Moab were called Emin. Now these Emin were said to be in Shava Kiriathaim. That is basically the town of Dibon. I'm not sure how one should pronounce that. Dibon is a well-known city. Again, when you study the Exodus and how they came up through there, Dibon is mentioned. It's just well known. And so that is Shava Kiriathaim, or just barely north of that city, which you can see on the map. So basically, to summarize, the four kings of Mesopotamia, they didn't cross directly from Mesopotamia across the Arabia Petraea, the Arabian Desert, to get to the Jordan River. They had to go up the fertile Tigris-Euphrates Valley, the Mesopotamian Valley. Then they curled over southern Syria under the mountains up there in Syria on the edge of the desert. And then they started coming down the east of the Jordan. They've gotten all the way down, about halfway down the east coast of the Dead Sea. We go to verse 6. Again, we're talking about who these Elamite Confederate kings are going to attack, verse 6, and the Horites in their Mount Seir, as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. Now, the Horites are in Mount Seir, so you go further down the east coast of the Dead Sea, and you get right to the southeast of the Dead Sea, and also to the south of the Dead Sea, you see Mount Seir, which is not one mountain, it's a mountain range, and that's where the Edomites famously lived. And there were Horites there too, and they were defeated. Now, these Horites used to be thought to be cavemen, troglodytes, if you will. Easton's Illustrated Dictionary, written in the late 1800s, says this, quote, cavemen, these Horites were, a race of troglodytes who dwelt in the limestone caves which abounded in Edom. Their ancestor was Seir. Remember, Edom is where Mount Seir is. Their ancestor was Seir, who probably gave his name to the district where he lived. They were a branch of the Hivites, which are mentioned in Genesis and other places. They were dispossessed by the descendants of Esau, and as a people gradually became extinct. So the Horites were run out by the Edomites, of whom Esau was the progenitor. The NIV Study Bible says of the Horites that they were formerly thought to be cave dwellers. The Hebrew word hor means cave. They are now known to have been the Hurrians, a non-Semitic people widely dispersed through the Middle East. And if you read ancient history, Hurrians show up an awful lot. Not that I know anything about them. I'm just familiar with the name. Now, after having conquered the Horites, which is in Mount Seir, right south of the Dead Sea in Edom, in the place that was later called Edom. Now the four kings, led by Chedorlaomer of Elam, head further south, all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba, or actually to the west of the Gulf of Aqaba, to El Paran, which, according to my atlas.org map, is to the west of Mount Sinai in the northern Sinai Peninsula, but it's basically in the wilderness down there in the Sinai Peninsula. It has a question mark, so they're not dead sure. Here's what BibleAtlas.org says about Paran. El Paran was the point farther south reached by the kings. Septuagint renders El by Terebinthos and reads unto the Terebinth of Paran, or the Oak of Paran. The evidence is slender, but it is not unreasonable to suppose that this is the place elsewhere called Eilat, which I've been there, a seaport town which gave its name to the Gulf of Aqaba, or the Elinitic Gulf, which is like Eilat, Elinitic, but now it's called the Gulf of Aqaba. Actually, I haven't been. Yes, that's where I was. I was at Eilat. I couldn't remember where I was. The Gulf of Aqaba is the branch of the Red Sea that branches off to the right of the Sinai Peninsula, to the east of the Sinai Peninsula, and the Suez branch of the Red Sea branches off to the left of the Sinai Peninsula. And so the Mesopotamians, all the way down there in Mount Sinai, all the way south of the Dead Sea, heading all the way down to the Red Sea, to the Sinai Peninsula. It's called the Wilderness of Paran, which I'm not surprised. Almost everything in Sinai is a wilderness. I've been through there. And boy, you don't want to get let out of a car somewhere without a compass and a big bottle of water going through that place. We go to verse 7, Genesis 14. Then they turn back. Again, the they is the four kings under Elam, under Chedorlaomer of Elam. They turned back and came to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and conquered all the country of the Amalekites, the Amalekites, and also the Amorites who lived in Hazazon Tamar. Now, En-Mishpat is the name of Kadesh Barnea, which is a well-known place if you study the Exodus. En-Mishpat may not be so well-known, but it's the same place, different name. Kadesh is also called Kadesh Barnea. Kadesh means holy. It's the sacred desert of wandering, a place on the southeastern border of Palestine, about 165 miles from Horeb, that's Mount Sinai. So you're going north from Mount Sinai, about 165 miles. Several miles to the west of the Dead Sea. If I can remember, it's about halfway up the Dead Sea. That was the place the Israelites went and stopped and didn't get into the Promised Land. It lay in the wilderness or desert of Zin, or Tsin as they call it. It's on the border of Edom. From this place, in compliance with the desire of the people, Moses sent forth 12 spies to spy the land. After examining it and all its districts, the spies brought back an evil report, Joshua and Caleb alone giving a good report of the land. So that's why Kadesh Barnea is famous, because that was the last stopping place on the way into the Promised Land. And so the four kings of Elam went back to that place, Kadesh. They conquered all the country of the Amalekites. The Amalekites were a tribe that dwelt in Arabia Petraea. That's the area between the Dead Sea and the Red Sea. The southern end of it is the Sinai Peninsula. And also goes further on up. Well, I better not say how far it goes up because I can't remember. But it's the area between the Dead Sea and the Red Sea. That same desert, it might have a different name. I think it's Arabia Felix, as it keeps going up between the Jordan and the Euphrates River all the way up to Damascus. That's why St. Paul is said to dwell in Arabia when he left Damascus. It's not down here in the south, it's up there in the north, right south of Damascus. Now, the Amalekites are famous because they attempted to stop the Israelites when they were marching on their exodus. God wasn't happy with them, and they got the wrath of God poured out on them for that unfortunate incident. Now, the four kings of Mesopotamia under Chedorlaomer of Elam also conquered the Amorites, as it says in verse 7. Now, who are the Amorites? They're pretty famous in ancient Near Eastern history. According to Easton's, I'm going to skip through here and read you some stuff from Easton's. They were called Highlanders or Hillmen, the name given to the descendants of one of the sons of Canaan. That's in Genesis 14:7. They were called the Amura or the Amuri in the Assyrian and Egyptian inscriptions, and the Amuri show up a lot. The Amorites are very famous in ancient Near Eastern history. In fact, at one time, they spread all the way in Assyria down into the Mesopotamian Valley, if I remember correctly. On the early Babylonian monuments, all Syria, including Palestine, is known as the land of the Amorites. So you see, they weren't just one of those Girgashite, little tiny Canaanite tribes. They were big dogs. The southern slopes of the mountains of Judea are called the Mount of the Amorites. They seem to have originally occupied the land stretching from the heights west of the Dead Sea to Hebron, embracing all Gilead and all Bashan. That's to the east of the Jordan River and on up north, right to the east of the Sea of Galilee, Lake Hula way up there as you're heading towards Syria. So you see they spread out over a long, a big area. With the Jordan Valley on the east of the river, that's Gilead, they were there too, the land of the two kings of the Amorites, Sihon and Og, those famous guys that are met in Deuteronomy as the Israelites tried to cross over the Jordan River. The five kings of the Amorites were defeated with great slaughter by Joshua. They were again defeated at the waters of Merom by Joshua, who smote them till there were none remaining. It is mentioned as a surprising circumstance that in the days of Samuel there was peace between them and the Israelites, because usually there was not peace between them and the Israelites. The Amorites were warlike mountaineers. They are represented on the Egyptian monuments with fair skins, light hair, blue eyes, aquiline noses, and pointed beards. Of course, the Egyptians were kind of a reddish-brown color, and there's enough color left in those monuments that you can actually tell the racial differences between the Egyptians and the Amorites. They are supposed to have been men of great stature. Their king, Og, as in Og of Bashan, their king Og is described by Moses as the last of the remnant of giants in Deuteronomy 3, verse 11. If I remember correctly, one of those kings up there, and I can't remember which one it was noted for having a huge bed. People remembered how big his bed was because he was so big. At any rate, the Amorites got beat too, so General Larmer's, he's like Sherman marching through Georgia. He's taking names and kicking rear. Now, the Amorites lived in Hazazon Tamar. Now, that's an old name for En-Gedi. Hazazon Tamar means Hazazon of the palm trees, and forgive me if I pronounced that wrong. It is identified with En-Gedi according to BibleAtlas.org, and En-Gedi is a town almost halfway up the west coast of the Dead Sea. Now, I've been by there on the road running south from Jerusalem down to the Negev, and it's really interesting because you see all the, there's still palm trees all around there. And those other, what do they call them? I can't remember, the tamarisk trees, the other kind of dark, bushy-like trees that are everywhere. And I was shocked to see a McDonald's there. I'm still shocked to think about seeing a McDonald's there at En-Gedi. En-Gedi was noted for an oasis, a place with palm trees and beautiful, lush stuff because of the river that ran into the Dead Sea there. And I asked my tour guide, I said, who in the world goes to a McDonald's in the middle of the desert? And he said there were lots of people around, like Bedouins, for example, people that wandered around in the desert, as well as other people from far away that sent their kids to school around there, and they went a long way, and they needed to have a place to eat, and so they would eat at McDonald's. I said, well, that's interesting. We go now to Genesis 14, verses 8, 9, and 10. And the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah. Now we're going to look at the defense, the guys, the Salt Sea, five kingdoms, cities of the plain, as they try to defend against this invasion force. And the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah and the king of Admah and the king of Zeboim and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. Remember, those are the five cities of the plain, all south of the Dead Sea or southeast of the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea. They came out and they arrayed for battle against them in the Valley of Siddim, that's the Salt Sea, against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. I just listed the four Mesopotamian kings again. Now, the Valley of Siddim was full of tar pits. You can still see tar floating in the southern Dead Sea, I understand, according to my NIV study Bible. So it was full of tar down there, bitumen. And the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and they fell into them. They fell into the tar pits. Those who survived fled to the hill country. They had to flee to the hills, as they say, to climb. If they'd have gone back home, they would have gotten sacked. The cities were getting sacked, and they would have been destroyed. So they ran up into the hills and hid. Pretty humiliating defeat. The Semites beat the Canaanites, beat the Hamites slash Canaanites. Now, the king of Sodom who ran up into the hills, we assume the kings of Sodom did not fall into the tar pits and die, but survived in the hill country, because we hear of him afterwards in Genesis 14, verse 17, which I'll get to in a minute. Then after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him, meet Abraham. Well, maybe that's John Gill's idea, but, you know, it seems to me there might be a successor king in Sodom, so maybe the king of Sodom got killed. We don't know. We go now to Genesis 14, 11, and 12. Then they, that's the four kings of Mesopotamia under Chedorlaomer of Elam, they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. That's what conquering nations did back then. They plundered. They either plundered or they left a garrison in the city and collected taxes, or they burnt the city down, or they took the people into captivity and then burnt the city down, or they took the people into captivity and left the city standing. They had several options. Here, these guys just plundered. They just took their stuff. Verse 12, they also took Lot, Abram's nephew, and his possessions and departed, for he was living in Sodom. Now, living in Sodom, the NIV Study Bible says that Lot, therefore, has moved into the town from the country, and he was living among the wicked people of the city. They quote 2 Peter 2:7 through 8, and if he rescued righteous Lot oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard that righteous man while living among them. So he was in the city being tormented by all the garbage, kind of like I'm tormented by all the garbage in America. He was tormented by all the people in Sodom. Lot felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds. But John Gill says, on the contrary, that Lot was still living in the countryside, said he was living in the countryside and he would still go into town and be tormented by all the righteous deeds. Well, whatever. He wasn't happy with what was going. He wasn't happy with what was going on in Sodom. And so the four kings of Mesopotamia departed. They probably went into the wilderness where it was impossible to chase them, especially since the kings of the five cities of the plain were either dead or living up in or escaped up into the mountains. So they went off scot-free, totally conquering. Now let's look at what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about Lot, who was captured now, heading back north, heading back to Elam, well, north and then back south, down the Mesopotamian Valley to Elam. That's his fate, would have been if Abram hadn't rescued him. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about Lot. Quote, how would the conscience of that young man now upbraid him for his selfish folly and ingratitude in withdrawing from his kind and pious relative, that's Abram. Whenever we go out of the path of duty, we put ourselves away from God's protection and cannot expect that the choice we make will be for our lasting good. So he chose the rich lands of Sodom and Gomorrah for his pasture, and as a result, he ended up being a POW. Abram, on the other hand, had the less prosperous lands in central Canaan, but nonetheless ended up being rich and powerful enough to go rescue his Lot. He didn't have any ill feelings toward him about that division of land that occurred when Lot really should have let Abraham choose which land he was going to have and let Lot have what was left over. We go to Genesis 14:13. Then a fugitive came and told Abram the Hebrew. Now he was living by the oaks of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and the brother of Aner. And these were allies with Abram. Now, the oak of Mamre, it says the oaks of Mamre. I'm not sure why. Sometimes it's called oak and sometimes oaks. But it's in Hebron, which is, again, about halfway up the Dead Sea on the west coast. There, the southern end of Israel. That's where he's living. And remember, Mamre is not Moreh. That Moreh, the oak of Moreh, is in Shechem. This is oak of Mamre, which is different. He's got three Amorite allies, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner. He's called Abram the Hebrew in this verse. And as a matter of fact, as the NIV Study Bible points out, Abram is the first biblical character to be called a Hebrew. Now here's what Easton says about that name, Hebrew. It was a name applied to the Israelites in Scripture only by one who is a foreigner, or by the Israelites when they speak of themselves to foreigners. That reminds me, when I was in China, I was sometimes called an American, but most of the time I was just called a foreigner. Or when spoken of as contrasted with other peoples. In the New Testament, there's the same contrast between Hebrews and foreigners. The derivation of the name, here's the most common derivation, I think. The name is derived, according to some, from Eber, mentioned in the Table of Nations in Genesis 10, verse 24, the ancestor of Abraham. The Hebrews are sons of Eber in Genesis 10, 21. That's one possible way that Hebrews got to be called Hebrews. Others trace the name of a Hebrew root word signifying to pass over, and hence regard it as meaning the man who passed over, i.e. passed over the Euphrates from Haran going on into Israel. Well, whatever, that's just interesting. It's not of great importance. Abram was called the Hebrew, probably because he was contrasted as a foreigner compared to the Amorites, whose land it was that Abraham was living in as a foreigner, as an alien, as a stranger. Now, according to the NIV Study Bible, the word Hebrew had a negative connotation. It's mainly used by non-Israelites in the Bible in a disparaging sense. Genesis 39, verse 17, we read this, then she, that's Potiphar's wife, spoke to him, her husband Potiphar, with these words, the Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came in to me to make sport of me. In other words, this nasty Hebrew came in here to rape me, which, of course, was a lie. There you see a little bit of negative. I mean, it could be. It could be no non-negative. I don't know why the NIV Study Bible is so sure about that. It could be she was just identifying the slave. Outside the Bible, the term, a similar term is used to describe the Jews, the Habaru or the Apiru, which is probably related to Hebrew and is used on the monuments in Egypt, for example, Mesopotamia. It doesn't refer to an ethnic group, Habiru or the Apiru. It's rather a term referring to social class, people that were foreign, propertyless, dependent, and immigrant. Negative descriptions are given of the Hebrews in Amarna tablets. Amarna tablets came from Egypt. It's interesting that this description describes the state of the Jews often through history as propertyless, dependent, and immigrant. The Jews have had a very, very tough history. Now, Mamre was one of Abraham's Amorite allies. The word means manliness. Now, we don't know anything more about Eshcol and Aner, the two Amorite brothers of Mamre. We go now to Genesis 14, verses 14 through 16. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, that's Lot, had been taken captive, he led out his trained men, born in his house, 318, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them, and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. He brought back all the goods and also brought back his relative Lot with his possessions and also the women and the people. Now, Abram is said in these verses to have beat the Mesopotamian kings with his 318 servants. And it was at Dan, I think, that he captured Lot or recaptured Lot, got Lot back. It doesn't say really. It says the Abram beat the Elamite kings, the Mesopotamian kings at Dan, and then pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. Well, let's do a little geography here. If you're at Lake Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River goes north of the Sea of Galilee up to Caesarea Philippi, which is the origins of the Jordan River. And halfway up in that stretch there, right north of Lake Hula, the little lake right north of the Sea of Galilee, you will see Dan. The city of Dan, not the tribe now, the city of Dan. Then, if you go a little bit further, you'll hit Caesarea Philippi. Then if you stretch out east, northeast, mainly east, a little bit north, you end up at Damascus. And north of Damascus was a place called, was an area called Hobah. And so there was a chase. Abram chased the coalition of Elam all the way up north of Damascus. And somewhere along the way, either at Dan or in Damascus or somewhere in between, he got Lot back. Not only Lot, but also all the goods and also the women, because not only did Lot get captured, but also Lot's female relatives had gotten captured by Chedorlaomer and his coalition. Now, Dan was a well-known city. However, it was not given the name Dan until the days of the Judges in Judges 18:29. The NIV Study Bible says that what we have here is an editorial update subsequent to Moses' time calling it Dan, and able to handle the anachronism. However, John Gill doesn't say there's an anachronism. He says that there was probably some place that may have been called Dan at Abram's time. We just haven't discovered it yet. Either way, doesn't matter. The name of the city used to be called Leshem or Laius, as John Gill says. Now, Gill says it was called Caesarea Philippi, but not according to the Atlas.org map. Caesarea Philippi was further north. I've been to Caesarea Philippi, by the way. It's an interesting place. Beautiful waters and trees and such. I remember thinking it was very, very nice. Caves there with Greek gods in there. Pan. In fact, it was called Pan at one time, or Ban something. I forgot the name of it now. It's not called Caesarea Philippi anymore. That's what it was called during the Roman occupation times. But at any rate, Abraham got Lot back. Abraham had traveled about 124 miles from Hebron, the Oaks of Mamre, up until Dan. The fact that he had 318 retainers shows the immense wealth of Abraham, as the NIV Study Bible says, because he sent armed retainers after an army. Now, Chedorlaomer probably had a couple thousand troops. Let's read what Adam Clark says about this. Quote, it required both considerable courage and address in Abram to lead him to attack the victorious armies of these four kings with so small a number of troops. And on this occasion, both his skill and his courage are exercised. His affection for Lot appears to have been his chief motive. He cheerfully risked his life for that nephew who had lately chosen the best part of the land and left his uncle to live as he might on what he did not think worthy, what Lot did not think worthy of his own acceptance. but it is the property of a great and generous mind not only to forgive, but to forget offenses, and at all times to repay evil with good. There's a shout-out for Abraham. I do think something that Clark didn't mention is that kinship obligations were probably much greater back then, now, in the East than they are in the West. I say that having lived in China for so long, I just cannot believe the family connections in China. I had a student here who received a television set. She was staying here, and she had a fifth cousin who was working in Detroit and came by this my house here and gave this Chinese student a TV set. The Chinese student had never seen her fifth cousin. He was about in a generation older than her, and they looked at each other like they were old, long-lost relatives, which they were, I guess, but, I mean, just crazy. Stuff like that we would never do. And I suspect that Abraham had to take care a lot because of the tribal duties, clan duties back then. Now, he beat that army, which probably was a couple thousand people, I would think. He beat that army with 318 people, but we also have to remember he also had allies, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner, the three Amorites. They probably had some people to help him too, so it's still a pretty remarkable feat on the part of Abraham. John Gill says that the fact that the four Mesopotamian kings had captured Lot, that was contrary to the law of nations because Lot was only a sojourner, not a combatant. Well, I don't know about that. I've read enough ancient history to see people in cities, especially those that refused to surrender, they got enslaved, chopped down, killed, murdered, robbed, and that was very common. So I'm not sure. I don't know how you would say that was contrary to the law of nations. But at any rate, he was captured anyway. Why did Abraham divide his forces? John Gill says to attack the four kings separately, the four kings, namely Tidal of Goim, Amraphel of Shinar, Chedorlaomer of Elam, and the king of Ellasar, whose name slips my mind right now. So some people say that's why he divided, and he might have divided it this way. Abram's troops, or soldiers, Mamre's soldiers, Aner's soldiers, Eshcol's soldiers, for a group of four soldiers that went in to take them out. Or it could be just to attack four different quarters of the enemy's camp. At any rate, it came by surprise. It was at night. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says. This war between the petty princes of ancient Canaan is exactly the same as the phrase in skirmishes between Arab chiefs in the present day. When a defeated party resolves to pursue the enemy, they wait till they are fast asleep. Then, as they have no idea of posting sentinels, they rush upon them from different directions, strike down the tent poles. If there is any fight at all, it is the fray of a tumultuous mob. A panic commonly ensues, and the whole contest is ended with little or no loss on either side. Again, that happens with cocky people. They win and they think that nobody's going to get them and they don't post sentinels. And they sit around and get drunk, eat a lot. Next thing you know, the defeated enemy has trailed them and whips up on them. Let's talk about these women captives that were released to Abraham or recaptured by Abraham. Lot's female relatives, quote, "Other spoils the routed Confederates might have left behind, and yet on their swift asses, camels, and dromedaries have carried off their female captives. However, Abram had disposed his attack so judiciously and so promptly executed his measures that not only all the baggage, but all the females also were recovered." In other words, you can carry the women off faster than you can pack up the camels with personal property, but nonetheless, they didn't even have time to do that. I don't know if that's actually true, that you can get women packed off faster than stuff. Probably so. You can just put them on the back of the camel and run. Didn't matter. Abram got those back too. This was a total smashing defeat for the man who believed God and unto whom it was reckoned as righteousness. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm finished now with Genesis 14:1-16, Abraham rescuing Lot. And now we're going to see as Abram returns back south, back down toward Hebron, he's going to be blessed by Melchizedek. And we're going to see the beginning of the so-called, or the typology that undergirds the so-called Melchizedek priesthood of Jesus. We'll see that in our next audio, verses 17-24 of Genesis 14. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.